How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children.
I'm so excited to be with you this week. It's such a special episode, so please bear with me. Around the world, thousands of podcasters are coming together for a global movement called Podcastathon. A collective effort that started in France to shine a light on charities and the people dedicating their lives to making the world a better place. It reminds me that storytelling is powerful, and it's something I've been dedicated to for more than three decades of my life. When we share the work of people creating change, we help amplify their mission. We inspire action and connect communities who care. That is the exact mission of this podcast. Today's conversation is one that sits very close to my heart. My guest is Shakira Todd, founder and managing director of Wildlife Surrounds and president of the Wildlife Surrounds Conservation Fund. Shakira has spent more than 15 years working in the environmental management, conservation, and land stewardship space across Australia. With a background in zoology and hands-on experience as an environmental scientist, park ranger, and conservation project manager, she has dedicated her career to protecting native ecosystems and educating communities about how humans and wildlife can coexist. On her property in North Queensland, surrounded by eucalypt woodland and neighbouring Bowling Green Bay National Park, Shakira leads conservation initiatives that support native flora and fauna, research partnerships with universities, and educational programs that reconnect people with the natural world. That's something we need more than ever today. She's also a passionate advocate for one of Australia's most misunderstood native species, the dingo, promoting their vital role as an apex predator in maintaining healthy ecosystems. And before we commence this discussion, I'd like to acknowledge Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the first inhabitants and traditional custodians of this land. We pay our respects to elders past and present and acknowledge the deep and enduring connection First Nations people hold with country. A relationship built on knowledge, stewardship, and respect. Shakira, I'm so grateful that you agreed to have this conversation with me. I know how busy you are and also how private you can be. I'm really intrigued though. What's your first memory of feeling really connected with nature?
First memory that I recall is being camping. I think it might have even been around the Kaya family holiday. Mum and Dad often tell the story when I was maybe two or three and look out the window of the tent and say, "Hey, Mum and Dad, look at all the wobblies." So I think there was always like a strong interest from, you know, a toddler age. But even older, I moved around a lot because my dad was in the Air Force. So there was, you know, a move every few years and sometimes, you know, every 6 months. And, you know, brought me out to the Northern Territory to live in Katherine during Year 7 and just exploring around there and just seeing all the different wildlife and different landscapes that really kind of piqued my interest and led me to work experience at Australia Zoo in grade 10 and then a Bachelor of Science majoring in zoology straight out of high school.
Often parents think that, you know, moving children from school to school can be really detrimental for their social and educational development. What was your experience in relation to moving around a lot with your dad?
I personally really enjoyed it. I still keep in contact with, you know, kids from primary school or kids from high school all the way through. But I guess for me, it was an exciting and a new opportunity. My brother didn't enjoy the move as much as me, but I guess every kid's different and I just really enjoyed it and loved just to see new places. It definitely wasn't easy going to a new school. Like I did obviously find that quite overwhelming initially. And then different dynamics from, you know, a state school in the western suburbs of Melbourne to then moving into a private school in Toowoomba in grade six. You know, I went from thinking that it was cool to bully people to being outcasted because I was trying to be bullying people to be cool. And then that was like a short, sharp shift to like, oh, that's not how we behave here, and had to adjust my whole social dynamics, which didn't take me long because I realised it was the wrong thing to do and I was being a bully and it's not nice to be a bully. But I guess just changing those dynamics from school and area of the state. And I think what I was lucky to have was a close-knit family group that mum and dad had through their friends in the Air Force. So although we might not live close together, there was always those camping trips and get-togethers that I'd maintain those long, constant friendships.
I can see a real adventurer in you. You seem to be, you know, the sort of person who loves to go places. And I know you've done a couple of trips with your dad. What part of that adventure spirit do you think came out of your ability to adapt and adopt new patterns, new strategies, new places, new people, as well as cultures? Because you've also been connected with Indigenous cultures as well.
Yeah. I think my first experience being connected to Indigenous culture was living in the Northern Territory in Katherine. And that was a different experience, which I learned to learn a lot about and opened up, you know, different aspects of Australia that I hadn't necessarily been educated about. I think my sense of adventure really came from my parents and my parents' friends. It was always camping and ball driving and, oh, what's down this track? Let's go have a look. And we were always planning trips away. I was lucky enough to travel overseas quite a bit. I spent 6 weeks in the United States of America, and then included in that trip a trip to Canada and Mexico. So that really piqued my interest on how many different cultures and experiences there are across the world. And I definitely think the camping and ball driving that we did on weekends on regular basis is, and there was always a sense, I think, not necessarily from my parents themselves, but we always had really strong ethics around sustainable camping, and family friends would make us pick up gloves on, pick up cigarette butts, and I'll give you some lollies once you finish. You know, it was always that sustainable mindset of leaving an impact and enjoying nature and its beauty and how much we can go and explore, but doing the right thing, staying on the right tracks, not causing erosion on the sand dune.
You've maintained a connection with Indigenous culture through your conservation work. How does their perspective on wildlife and Australian flora and fauna in general impact you today?
I think there's a sense of passion that just exceeds anything that I've been exposed to historically. I was just over in WA on a field school with the Savannah Guides and, you know, spoke to Indigenous rangers at homesteads there and the work that they've done finding bowls and different things. And then we would talk about, you know, looking at scats and their experiences of learning and, you know, talking about their family history and some very recent traumatic history that's happened. I think it's the 100-year anniversary to a large massacre that happened over there. But then those stories that flow on of Dreamtime and how those creation stories, it really comes from deeper within than I've ever seen from my own family or growing up as a European Australian. And working closely in relation to dingoes and the First Nations passion around that, particularly hearing words throughout a forum where it was a First Nations dingo declaration that was written by traditional owners from across Australia, where they don't just see dingoes as Australian wildlife, they see them as family and they see them as part of the country, and without them, country gets sick. So it's having a different view or different way of explaining it and different emotions, but it aligns with modern day science that is published by you know, really reputable ecologists.
I absolutely adore dingoes and have always loved seeing them in the wild. You actually have a license to keep them under your conservation you do on your property. How did you first become a custodian?
Yeah, it was an accident, really. Never saw my life kind of heading this way when it first happened, and that was 10 years ago now, when I was stuck in a loop of trying to find a job beyond a degree. And that led me to Victoria, working in conservation and land management for Oz Eco Solutions, who I still maintain a close relationship with now. At that point, they asked myself, 3 weeks into the job, to go deliver a baiting program on a property for a client. That made my hands sweat and my heart race, because 1080 baiting isn't a suitable control method in most landscapes that it's used. And it really made me kind of get the drive behind me to find alternatives without cracking up and saying no, because I had 3 days to get this sorted. So that meant that weekend I went to the Australian Dingo Foundation, where the founders, Lynn Watson and her now late partner, Peter, I spoke to them about and said, I'm in a bit of a predicament. I know people who are pro-dingo, anti-1080 baiting. Can you give me any research or information to take back to my employers, because I want to build a case as to why I don't want to do it without just saying I don't want to do it? Their solution was, well, what's the reserve? How big is it? 300 hectare reserve in a offset of a development near Melton. And they said, well, why don't you just put a couple of dingoes in there and they'll maintain that whole ecological balance by restoring the apex predator. It will mean that there'll be less macropods that frequent the area. So there was large eastern grey kangaroos, which were overgrazing. So were the pest rabbits. And they were all eating all the herbs and native grasses for our small native mammals. Fat-tailed dunnart comes to mind. And then there were predators, so cats and foxes. So the idea was to fence off that reserve so that it wasn't a threat to neighbouring livestock, because there's a big sheep industry in that area as well. So we didn't want to impact on neighbouring farmers throughout this project. So that would be contained and it would become a bit of a feature that people would come and learn about dingoes. And that was supposed to all go ahead smoothly. We had the approval from state government and local government, support from the developer, landholders, except for one landholder who thought that he'd start a change.org petition because he's worried about his diamond firetail bird, which fly, dingoes don't fly. Cats and foxes are more likely to attack that bird than a dingo, and dingoes will maintain and deter cats and foxes from being there. Long story short, the change.org petition got hundreds of thousands of signatures, mainly from people internationally who had no context of the scenario and didn't understand the ecology. And as a result, that led to negative media. Prior to that, it was all positive. And that negative media got the attention of the livestock industry. And as a result, the funding that we had for that project, which was quite significant from a large environmental organisation, everyone got cold feet. Understandably, the project just caved. And I felt responsible for Austin and Ayla. I made a lot of good relationships with academics and advocates, conservationists, just really good people who all shared the same vision. So not long after that, I moved back to Townsville because Melbourne's too damn cold and I couldn't do another winter. Bought this property and started basically with a passion to educate the local public and also our younger generation, who are going to be our next policymakers, who will make decisions around, you know, native wildlife and native ecosystems and rules in place to protect the species that need it and the ecosystems and the greater environment, really.
So Austin and Ayla were your first two. How did you become the custodian of two more dingoes post that? And they are very different colours.
They are, and that's how two turned into four, even though three of our dingoes are your classic tan or sandy colour that you might see or observe on Gari and most of the biggest population on mainland Australia. Jimba is a black, white and tan dingo, and there was an opportunity to get him from another zoo or wildlife park. So I took that opportunity, and of course Jimba needed a mate, so that meant we got Jali as well. I think probably more than 50 or 60% of the time people come and see Jimbo, he goes, oh, he's not a dingo, or he just looks like a kelpie. And that really is the basis of the education around, you know, more information that we're getting through recent research about genetics, around purity, and that coat colour doesn't matter. There can be a variety of colours, and dingoes can have no domestic dog ancestry in the wild. And it's a recessive genetic trait. So it's, you know, going into the details of genetics, which I don't need to, but it is a less common than the dominant tan colour.
It's a really interesting thing to think that people will look at a dingo and identify it with dogs. And there has been a lot of talk historically that some of our, you know, working dogs are crossbred with dingoes. So how then do you manage that conversation, particularly around dog management in Australia, where they can classify hybrids as wild dogs and then eradicate them from the landscape?
Yeah, I think it is a lack of education. People aren't aware of recent research that has been published, you know, particularly over the last 10 years, and B, willingness to acknowledge academic research, which is accurate. You know, DNA, genetics, it's hard to tell a fuzzy around it and, you know, not tell the truth. So it's pretty apparent that there is dingoes in mainland Australia that don't have any domestic dog ancestry. And we sent away 5 samples from roadkill. So I have collected little samples from roadkill between my property here in the Burdekin on Bindle country and then, you know, around towards Townsville. And all 5 of those samples came back with no domestic dog ancestry. They were sent to Dr. Kylie Cairns from the University of New South Wales, who's a really great geneticists and scientists, and we are seeing that happen very often with samples that are coming in for DNA analysis. So that myth that I used to tell as a young person working at the local zoo out of uni, that there aren't any pure dingoes left on mainland Australia except for maybe a small population in the Simpson Desert and then on Gari, we now know that's just completely not true. There's pure dingoes, or dingoes without domestic dog ancestry, so a separate species, which is isolated when you look at their genetics compared to wolves and other canines around the world. And we need to start acknowledging that and calling dingoes instead of a term wild dog, which puts them into that automatic assumption that they're mongrels who have interbreeded and they're wild dogs, they're not dingoes, they need to be shot, baited, trapped because they are a pest. That's not true. If we started saying that we're doing dingo control across mainland Australia, the public will have a completely different perception about it.
The other perception is that they're aggressive and that they attack people, right? Now, we've had Azaria Chamberlain, we've had Gari Island. I remember being on Gari Island in the 80s when it was known as Fraser Island. And I also live in a place north of Mackay in the hills where we have a dingo population, and I've witnessed them, and they are shy, they are reserved, they're very curious animals. Why do you think they've gotten this reputation more recently?
I think we have a very, very big human management issue on Gari. That is the reason. I don't think we should stop tourism on Gari, but I do often refer to my experiences on mainland Australia when I see a dingo in the wild doing field work or hiking, or, you know, around North Queensland, WA, South Australia. I've seen them across different areas, and I'm lucky if I can pull my phone out of my pocket to take a photo of them before they run away. Where we start seeing issues with dingoes and humans and aggression conflict, I'm not aware of a case where there hasn't been known scenarios where those dingoes have been fed or have had access to food, whether that be through rubbish bins or just throwing your prawn scraps in the bush after you've had a big feed of prawns down near the river. So if we remove, or I guess remove that food source, or that understanding that people are food, then the dingoes won't come anywhere near us, and they need to think of us as a threat and go off and live in the bush, which is where they need to be. That's where they belong. That's where they, you know, make country healthy by being that top order predator. then we won't see those conflict issues. And unfortunately, on Gari, there's been some really sad scenarios that have happened in recent times. But if you take away, or if we can manage the campers in a way that that education is promoted. I was talking to my brother just last weekend on a family trip. I'm like, what information was given to you when you went to Gari? I said, any information on the boat? And he said, no. And I said, what about when you booked? He goes, oh, it was a large booking. There was 30 people. So I didn't get any information until I was there for like maybe 4 days and the ranger came up and spoke to us. So that's a four-day window of my brother, who knows a fair bit because, you know, I'm his sister. But he wasn't given any of that information. So that there is a huge missed opportunity, a declaration or some kind of digital form or watching a presentation on the boat or passengers that get off the boat. My understanding, I haven't been there for 10 years, but there's no huge number of people that get on and off that ferry at one time. So why can't we take that opportunity and provide that education to the humans who inhabit it? Because tourism is a really important aspect to Gari and, you know, to the butcher, the traditional owners. So I think if we can just work on our own management of our own race and, you know, our own species, then I think it's going to help avoid a lot of those issues.
Agreed. You know, a lot of human interaction is what's causing much of the decline of natural species. And I did an interview recently with Anna Noon about how we are rated one of the highest in the world for an extinction rate on this continent. So quite sad. A lot of the work you do, and you did mention this a little bit earlier in our conversation, is with students, educating them. And I recently, last year, accompanied you on a trip to Magnetic Island where you took university students from America onto the island to do a koala study. Why is it so important for you to do that kind of work?
It definitely supports the vision and I guess the objectives of the Conservation Fund, which is to educate the public around Australian wildlife and ways that we can change our own behaviours or understanding to benefit the Australian ecosystem. I find it really rewarding working with the students. They're enthusiastic, they take away quite a bit of information and they have to interpret it in a way that a scientist would. So it's a day in the life of a scientist is how it's marketed. What's on the cards for wildlife surrounds in the future is really continuing those international education programs, but I guess targeting our local students from, you know, the ages of primary school for more of a fun activity to high school, and then working more with our local tertiary educators. I've been doing placement hosting for James Cook University now for 5 years. I think I had 22 students now to start their placement. I've got three working on the property at the moment. And that really is an opportunity to try and, I guess, be a mentor to young people and help them progress their career, because it is a bit challenging coming out of uni without that experience. And, of course, having that role in influencing or providing support to our next policymakers who will be making decisions around classifying dingoes as a native species only and not contradicting it with our biosecurity legislation where they're labelled as a pest animal.
It's becoming more and more apparent, and there's a lot of research around this now available, that it's those early childhood years that matter. And even you and your experience highlight that, you know, getting out in nature, seeing wildlife, being connected and feeling like you're part of it. You have a belonging, you know, with this country. How would you advise people encourage that curiosity and that connection in their children when they're young?
Just by walking outside, you know, in your local park, encouraging that curiosity by dragonflies that fly around and land on your picnic table, you know, like, what is that about? Or explain a little bit around their life cycle. And then I guess really encouraging that interest into something that is really phenomenal when you look at the different life cycles and behaviours of all different animals and how they interact. Camping, being outdoors, it's not for everyone. There are opportunities even with local ranger programs for little kids at local schools on school holidays. We've got a great business called Hands on Wildlife in Townsville who tour around and go see young kids and spark that interest in them. And they're the kind of events that really got my interest when I was a kid. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, camping and touring around Australia and moving around your whole life, but just by being exposed to those opportunities. I guess one thing that we're kind of going on repeat from my generation is I grew up in the generation where Steve Irwin became famous, you know, from pre-teens to in my late teens or early, maybe I was 19 or 20 when he passed away. And that was probably a big driver for me, which really piqued my interest. And now we've got the next generation of Irwins, particularly Robert, who's doing a great job at advocating for wildlife. And I really hope to see that cycle repeat and get our young people interested into wildlife and how they can play their part in conservation.
Well, that's a generational thing because I'm pretty sure Steve got it from his dad who passed it on down through. So it's just a wonderful to see that generational connection. And as you say, we all have the ability to encourage our children to be more curious about the world around us. How can people support the work you do, particularly with the dingoes? Because I know it's an expensive exercise. I've actually put my hand in my pocket before.
And we appreciate that. Thank you, Kim. So multiple ways. We have, you know, for our local residents, we obviously have Working Bees, so you can come and contribute to, you know, just helping out with managing a 40-acre property, which isn't easy, as many landowners know. We have sponsorship of our dingoes, an annual sponsorship, which covers the annual cost for vet bills and annual vaccinations, health checks, etc. Our reptiles also have sponsorship, which we use in the last 2 years of sponsorship, building them new enclosures. So they're animals that are in captivity, but their previous owners could no longer look after them. So we're providing forever homes here where they can be used to spark that interest in young generations, really. Even older people love them as well, or they run away the opposite direction. And we can also, we are registered with the ATO for deductible gift recipient status. So you can make a donation via our website, which is wildlifesurrounds.com.au, or directly you can put into social media or our link tree, and all those links are there to make donations.
I'll make sure they're all available after this episode. They'll be in the show notes. Shikira Todd, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me for this special episode that is going to be heard around the world through Podcast-thon.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kim.
Such a powerful conversation. And if it sparked something in you, maybe curiosity, hope, or a deeper appreciation for the wildlife that shares this country with us, then please consider supporting the work Shikira and her team are doing. Through the Wildlife Surrounds Conservation Fund, donations help support conservation projects, wildlife care, research partnerships, and education programs that empower communities to protect native ecosystems. From supporting students and researchers to maintaining wildlife enclosures to expanding programs that teach people how to coexist with indigenous species like dingoes. Every contribution helps protect Australia's unique biodiversity, something that it's known for around the world. You'll find links in the show notes to learn more about Wildlife Surrounds and how you can contribute. And if you loved this episode, please share it with someone who cares about the environment, wildlife, and the future we're shaping for the next generation. Because the lessons we pass on today about respect for nature, responsibility for our ecosystems, and compassion for all living things are exactly what we teach our children. I've made it as easy as possible for you by including all of the links to Shikira's websites, as well as a QR code you can scan to donate whatever you've got to give. Until we're together again, let's be the change we want to see in the world.